My name is Jeff Lerner, and I interview elite performers from a wide range of disciplines, entrepreneurs, athletes, celebrities, scientists, artists, and more. This is Unlock Your Potential. Welcome to another episode of Unlock Your Potential. Jeff Lerner, your host, always so excited to be back with you, having amazing conversations with amazing human beings. Today, we are joined by Dean Hall. Dean is a veteran in the coaching field. You know, there's a lot of coaches, especially these days on the internet. Like, my Instagram feed is overrun with coaches. This is not some new pop-up fly-by-night coach. This is a coach who's been coaching over 30 years and has over 50,000 hours of face-to-face coaching experience. Two-time cancer survivor, world record-setting extreme endurance athlete, and somebody who has this really, really exciting and unique vantage point, having personally been healed from cancer by experiences out in the wild, which I'm excited to get to hear more about, really bringing nature into his coaching modality and his healing modality. And I am super stoked to talk about this. Dean, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jeff. I can't tell you how much I've been looking forward to not only getting to meet you, but join you in your endeavors to change the world.
I appreciate that. Well, yes, let's change the world, starting with this episode's audience, man. So, you know, I feel like, you know, you when you're in the transformation business, obviously people want to know, well, like, well, what was your transformation, right? And so we all have this story. For me, it was broke high school dropout, broke jazz musician, made good, successful entrepreneur. For you, it's like, you know, again, the byline, right? The marquee would read, terminal cancer, you know, swam the length of the Willamette River, healed from cancer, and now transforming lives to pay it forward, right? Or like whatever. So yeah. I don't want to reduce you to that story by saying, okay, Dean, tell me your story, and that needs to be the story.
Sure.
But at least as a starting point, you know, who are you? How'd you get here? What happened? Yeah, like let's hear your hero's journey, whatever it turns out to be.
Okay. I'm a native of Portland, Oregon. I was one of the only lucky kids in the 60s. And I say that because I was the only kid I knew whose parents really just were crazy about each other. And so for me, that was the modeling and the kind of template that defined really what I was after in life. You know, my dad made a lot of money. He was very successful. Both my parents were mountaineers. But the thing that was the great adventure to me was finding somebody to really fall in love with and then making that happen and getting to pass off this kind of cascade of love to children of my own. Ever since I was a kid, I remember following my parents down a trail because we spent most of our weekends, all of our holidays, all of our vacations out backpacking and climbing in Oregon's just wild, beautiful forests and mountains. And one time I remember my dad chasing my mom down the trail. I was about 9 or 10. And rather than being grossed out, I was like, wow. And she's giggling and he's trying to grab her and thinking, you know, someday I want that to be me and some beautiful woman. So that was always the biggest part of the backdrop. And I got to do that. I grew up here climbing, which was just a wonderful childhood. But then I fell in love with soccer, got to play on the first Nike-sponsored youth team. They took us over the Premier League. And Jeff, that was kind of interesting because we thought we were such hot stuff. And then we went over and played under Liverpool and Wolverhampton and Manchester United's reserves. These are the subs. And they made us look like Bobo the Dancing Bear. You know, it was really humbling. But I had scholarships all over the U.S. And on a lark, I picked this small Christian college down in Kansas because I'd been to a church camp. I thought it was really fun. I thought, okay, for my first year, I'll go and play soccer at a year-long church camp and get college credit for it. It didn't quite turn out that way. It was not a pleasant experience, except I met this cute little Kansas farm girl and decided to put myself in exile for love. And so I moved down to Kansas, which was like moving onto the face of the moon for me. No forests, no rivers, no trees, no hills, definitely no mountains, just wheat fields and nice people. But lived there for 30 years.
Whereabouts in Kansas?
South Central, 60 miles south of Wichita, only 4 miles from the Oklahoma border. Okay. So deep in the heart of redneckery. I had a good ride. I taught public school for 20 years, and the hurts and miseries of those folks really kind of called me to becoming a therapist. So I put myself through school, became a therapist, did both for several years. About 13 years, I did both. Went and taught in the morning, then did therapy at night, building my private practice. And then did therapy for another 10, 15 years. And then that cute little Kansas farm girl died. She was the healthiest person I'd ever known. And we'd planned for what she was going to do when I died. But we never considered that she'd die and I'd be left. And when she did, it was really what started my spiral into hell.
How old were you when that happened?
I was 50 years old. Hmm. Yeah. So you thought by then I would be mature enough to be able to handle that kind of torment, but not so much.
Before I even hear the story, what I'll say is, you know, I think there's that's very interesting that like you're defining, let's call it your hero's journey. I did an episode yesterday where we talked about the hero's journey. So I have the hero's journey in my mind.
No, but it's like that. It's definitely on my mind.
That narrative for you, I mean, if it started at 50, I think there's a bias in society that like your greatness has, the seeds of your greatness have to all start being planted when you're very young. And at 50, it's far too late to have some transformational life pivot and so forth. So I'm actually grateful for the audience. Like I'm inspired by the idea that you have this whole other chapter that started at 50. That's great. Yeah. Let's hear about it.
A chapter I certainly wouldn't have chosen. The ironic thing is I was considered a grief expert in the Midwest. And once I experienced it myself, I realized, man, anything I'd ever known was just simple book knowledge. And I even called some of my old clients and apologized. And thankfully, they were gracious. But I told, man, I just had no idea. Yeah. And a year later, as many times it goes, the torment and the anguish of that, because she died 15 days before our 30th anniversary. And we'd had a really good marriage. Even though I was stuck in Kansas, I was happy to be, just to get to live with her and enjoy this rich friendship and great love life. And when I lost her, it was so awful that a year later I got leukemia and lymphoma. Mm. And it just kept ravaging my body. I've always been an athlete. After soccer, I started doing a lot of triathlons and loving endurance events. And I just let go of everything. And I went from very fit 212 down to 152 pounds in the next 3 years. By 2013, I'd moved back to Oregon, because Kansas without the cute little Kansas farm girl was Kansas. And so thinking that I could come back, be with my family, kind of restore and recover. And that's not what happened at all. Actually, I gave up the one last thing that I had anchored to my identity, and that was my professional life. And so all of a sudden, I'm renting for the first time, lost my wife, had $500,000 in out-of-pocket medical bills. And so I had to sell my home, cash in IRAs. All of a sudden, I'm pretty much broke and renting at 50 when I'd worked so hard to build this wonderful life. And I was just kind of done by August of 2013. But then I remembered, hey, I got a 21-year-old daughter that I adore. If I let this leukemia take me, that's pretty darn selfish because she just lost her mama. And so I've got to find a way to survive. And that's where my therapy practice really came in handy.
So your wife passed away, and I'm sorry if you said it, but how did she pass, if it's okay for me to ask?
No, I didn't say that. She had an inoperable brain tumor.
Okay, so she died of cancer.
Right.
And then a year later, you had what it sounds like was thought to be terminal cancer.
The first 6 weeks, the leukemia, they didn't know if it was acute or chronic. Because it had features of both, and the numbers were escalating by the thousands every day. And so initially they gave me 4 to 6 weeks.
Wow.
And my daughter, you know, was just freaking out. She thought she'd be an orphan at 21, you know, that everybody'd be gone. So I just knew I had to do something to live.
So you're 50 years old, 50-ish. And yeah, I guess where do we go from there?
Well, thankfully, I'd had a pretty thriving private practice and helped many people bring their lives back using Viktor Frankl's work, Man's Search for Meaning. And it was interesting.
Were you a formal logotherapy practitioner, or you just incorporated that?
I just incorporated it. I wasn't certified as a logotherapy. I'm impressed that you even know logotherapy. A lot of people don't. So kudos to you. But
I would call myself an amateur. I don't know. I can't call myself an amateur therapist. I don't think that's a thing. But I very much practice a purpose and meaning orientation as a curative and directive treatment for people's lives. That's very embedded in everything I do with my entire life. So, and I'm a huge, and I've read that book 4 times. So
have you really? Good for you. Yeah. And I just love his biography and how he didn't choose to go to Auschwitz, and he was dying, and he had always wanted to study what helped people overcome, but it wasn't ethical to stress people to that, that point. But then he realized, I didn't choose this, but I can use this. Mm-hmm. And I was down to 152 pounds. The biggest thing on me were my swollen lymph nodes under my jawline, and then what my oncologist lovingly called my hockey puck. It was the size and shape of a hockey puck under my right arm. Then I had 60 or 70 others. It was like gravel all over my body.
Wow.
And when I'd look at myself, I didn't recognize myself. You could see every rib. You could see my pelvic bones. I literally looked like those pictures of people coming out of Auschwitz. And that was the first time.
Only you have these lumps all over you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you, I'm curious. Do you have a picture? Not that you necessarily need to show it here, but I mean, do you keep a picture of that as kind of a reminder?
The funny thing is, you know, everybody on Instagram is doing these before and after pictures of cancer. It never occurred to me to take one. I mean, I didn't even want to look at myself, much less take a picture. And quite honestly, Jeff, I've thought about it a lot lately because I've been asked that question a lot. I didn't think I was going to live.
Yeah.
I didn't think there was going to be an after. So why take a before if there is no after?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
So, yeah. And I do have one picture, and this is so funny. I'll send it to you. The first day of my swim, this is June 3rd after swimming, forcing myself to swim for a year and get in shape for this endurance event that I challenged myself to. Well, and I thought I was so ripped. And man, I look stick thin. It's ugly.
So yeah, I obviously have read the story of the swim. Mm-hmm. I haven't read the book, but I've read much about the story. But yeah, I mean, help the audience understand, when we say the swim, we're not just talking about, hey, somebody's going to go swim some laps.
Yeah. No, I knew I had to have a purpose that I was passionate about. And so I started praying and asking, very prayerfully, because I don't know if you know it. You probably do. Heck, you knew about logotherapy. But the brain, by its very nature, has to answer every question you ask. Well, people have had the experience of thinking of a trivial question. What was that person's name? Or where did I leave my keys? And then all of a sudden it comes to mind while you're brushing your teeth. What a lot of people don't understand is that happens with every question you ask. And you can ask the deepest questions of your life and get that same wonderful response from your unconscious. And so I was using that at a very deep level several times a day, hoping that I'd get this wonderful, very complete answer. Well, a month later, it's still crickets. And so I'm starting to get really discouraged. And I look around, and I've been living in this little duplex and hadn't even put my bed together. I was laying on the floor. I was so depressed. I was laying on a mattress on the floor, which just isn't me. And I thought, well, you know, while I wait for God and the universe to answer me, maybe I should unpack these boxes and put my bed up and, you know, kind of act like an adult. And so one of the first boxes I opened was a box of childhood things my mom wanted to get out of her house. And one of them was a journal I'd been forced to keep in sixth grade. And so I'd forgotten I'd kept that or been forced to keep it, because what sixth grade boy keeps a journal, right? And so I open it and it says, when I get old, I gotta climb Mount Everest, swim the English Channel. And every time, it still happens, just a shot of electricity went through me and I started getting excited. I thought, okay, because my parents had been mountaineers. Dad's climbed every mountain on the West Coast. I've climbed most of them by the time I was 15. And I thought, okay, I know my numbers are so bad and my blood counts are so poor, I couldn't handle elevation, but I could swim the channel. I don't know why I thought that, but I started getting really excited about it. So immediately I Googled active cancer patient swim in the English Channel. There was no one. So I thought that's what I was going to do. And as life went on and as I started to swim and just getting in the pool and kicking off the edge, was the first time in 3 years I felt like myself again. But as time went on and the numbers all went in the right direction, which really surprised my oncologist, he's like, you're going to kill yourself. You know, your immune system's so poor, a public pool will kill you. I said, Doc, what do you want me to do? Die sitting on a couch watching Wheel of Fortune? I'm not going out that way. I got to do something. So I kept going. And finally, right around Christmas, I was starting to finally gain weight and my head was starting to clear. And I got out of the pool and it hit me. Who cares if another middle-aged man puts on a Speedo and swims to France? It does the world no good. And in my case, it's not going to be a pretty picture. So what could I do that would serve the world more? And that was a really important question. And within days, I remembered a 30-year-old dream that I'd had of swimming the longest river in my home state of Oregon, the Willamette. And it's 187 miles long. And when I remembered that, I quickly Googled to see if anybody had yet done it. No one had. And I just knew that's what I had to do. And it made me so excited because it was so much more organic. I had come back to this place that I love. I was born only 4 blocks from the Willamette River. And it would just be this beautiful time of hopefully, my only intent was hoping that I would inspire other cancer patients to refuse to give up simply because they've been diagnosed with something. And if I swim 187 miles, they might see me as an active cancer patient and think, okay, if that schlub can do that, maybe I can keep doing my own recovery at least. So that was my original intention.
So 187 miles, that seems, I don't know the exact measurements of the English Channel, but I've heard stories of people swimming it. I mean, that sounds comparable, I'd say. You tell me.
The English Channel is 22 miles.
Oh, it's only 22 miles across?
It's about, yeah, it's about nine times. And you can do it in about 12 hours or so.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So
it's nine times farther.
So you upped the ante considerably.
Considerably. Plus, the English Channel, other than getting hit by, you know, a freight liner or something, there aren't really many huge concerns. And with me, I went through a set of rapids the first day. There are all sorts of switchbacks. Oregon has huge 100-foot tall fir trees, and those fall in the river and create what's called strainers. And if you go under and get stuck in one of those, you're a goner. If you get stuck up against a boulder or a rock or a tree, only 1 mile an hour current creates 2,000 pounds of pressure. You're probably not getting off that baby. So I think there's a reason nobody had done it before. You know, you're kind of risking your life, even though to me it didn't seem like it at the time.
Well, so the theme here, and it's interesting, you talked about like when Viktor Frankl went to Auschwitz and he said, oh, I can use this. This is a laboratory in which an unethical experiment is already being conducted that I'm in a position to now observe, knowing that I would never conduct this experiment willfully.
Right.
I think about that dynamic where it's like, I say all the time, like I, you know, in my story, again, my tagline, it's like broke jazz musician. By the way, I was $495,000 in debt. I was overweight.
Wow.
I was depressed. I had two failed franchise restaurants. It was the Great Recession. I injured my wrist. I couldn't play piano. I was I lost my apartment. I had to move in with my estranged wife's parents. I'm living in their spare bedroom. So like I have this rock bottom, dark night of the soul, cathartic phase in my, but again, and so now when I work with people and in Entre and my, you know, all the impact I try to have in the world, I say all the time, like, oh, well, you're the struggle you're having is that I'll say to somebody, you haven't suffered enough. Like, yeah, you're in some pain and you want some change, but you know, if I could dial up the suffering, you know, the Latin word passio, which means suffer, is also the root of the word passion. The transmutation of suffering into passion is how these transformational energies are birthed. But you just haven't suffered enough. But I'm not here to try to make your life worse just so that it can get better. That would be unethical. It's kind of the same thing. But deep down, it's like I'm picturing you, and I don't presume to relate to that experience, but I'm picturing you as a gaunt, cancer riddled, you know, lunatic. a lunatic born of his own. I mean, the freest you can be in a sense is having nothing left to lose.
Right.
And then say, I'm going to go swim this damn river. And frankly, who the hell cares if I live or die? Because in some respects, I'm already dead and this is a shot. And like, so much beauty is born of those experiences in this life. And so I want to hear the rest of the story. I want to hear about the experience. But I also wonder if you can kind of, because again, thinking with the audience in mind, knowing that everybody at any given moment is experiencing some pain, and sometimes it has to get worse before it gets better. It's like, can you go into the mindset at that time? And if you agree with me, the freedom that comes from being at such a low point.
Yeah, it was a freedom I resisted for years. And that's what made me so sick.
So you got sick at 50. How old were you when you swam the river?
54.
So four years.
Three and a half years, it was just one thing after another. I woke up in the hospital twice where the doctor was looking at me scared and said, well, we called your family. We didn't think you were going to make it. And so I just had one thing after another, like you said, suffering. I tell everybody, it's really good to be on this side of that story. And a lot of my clients will say, Dean, I just want to grow as fast as I possibly can. And I say, no, you don't. I say, yeah, I really do. What could I do that would fast track this? Kind of hit the fast forward button. I said, suffering. That's what I always say. You don't want to do that. It's not,
you know what they call unregulated growth in the body?
What's that?
cancer.
Yeah.
You don't want to grow as fast as you can.
No, that's a great point. Yeah. And so my mindset was two things. One, I wanted to do something before I died that mattered, I felt. Two, how many people, I thought, you know, even if I don't succeed, how many people attempt to do something no one in history has ever accomplished before? That's pretty rarefied air. And even if I died, I felt like I'd leave my daughter a legacy of courage and hope because she saw me never give up. And so my love for my daughter was really what fueled the power and the passion to get through this. Little did I know, it scared the hell out of her. She thought I was trying to commit suicide or something, which was not even on my radar at all. I thought I was inspiring her. But the greatest mindset was, I tell myself every day, the extraordinary becomes possible when you make it impossible to remain ordinary. So there were many, many days, Jeff, where I didn't want to get my butt out of the house, out of bed, because my doctor said the type of leukemia that I had is mono on crack. It just makes everything hard, even just getting out of bed, exhausting. And so to then push yourself to get in the pool, and I started with 11 laps, and then every day I try to add one more, and pretty soon I'm doing 108 laps, which is about 3 miles a day. And it was absolutely exhausting because I also had lymphoma. Well, the lymph system only works when you move. And by moving it and having so many just filled with toxins, I knew that within an hour or two, I'd have severe flu-like symptoms because it was putting so many toxins back into my body. But that was part of the healing, and I had chosen that, and so I was ready to handle it. And every day I thought, what would be the normal, ordinary thing? Well, the normal, ordinary thing would be to just lay in bed and feel sorry for myself. The normal, ordinary thing would be to be mad about everything that happened. The normal, ordinary thing would be to binge Netflix all day. And so I would make that literally impossible for me to do. My dad is my hero. I just adore him. And so I'd call him every night. And I'd say, hey, this is how many laps I'm going to do tomorrow. And this is the time I'm going to do it. And he's like, good. Call me when you're done. And he actually sounds like that. And just knowing this man that I respect so much knew and that I kind of promised it almost made it impossible for me not to do it in my mind. And then secondly, I was living in this little duplex. It had a garage, but you had to walk out of the duplex to the garage and then go into the garage. There was no indoor access. So what I found I had to do, the only way I could watch Netflix, I didn't have a TV at that point. I just had my laptop. I take my laptop out at night, put it in the passenger seat of the car, pack my swim bag, put it on top of my laptop. And so when I woke up in the morning, when I was tempted to just stay in bed and binge on Netflix, in order to do that, I had to get up, get out of my house, go into my garage, lift my swim bag, take the laptop and walk back in, the walk of shame. By the time I'm lifting up my swim bag, I'm like, what the hell am I doing? This is stupid.
Right.
I'm just going swimming. And so I would just put up little roadblocks like that, or big ones, every day to make sure I couldn't continue to do the ordinary thing.
So I am so delighted that we just stumbled into this part of the conversation, this part of the story. You know, one of the concepts that I really, really emphasize and believe in deeply and have used on myself, kind of the same thing, like you're almost like trapping yourself into the good things, the good thing you should do, right? So I'll share this backdrop. I've read a book, another book I've read multiple times because it's been such an influence on me, no pun intended, is called Influence by Robert Cialdini.
Okay.
And it's called the six principles of persuasion. It's Influence, and then, or I think it's called The Psychology of Persuasion is like the subtitle, but it's got these six principles that drive human behavior. Mm-hmm. And they're, think of them as kind of like these embedded, they're built into the source code of personality. And I'll tell you what they are, there's liking. Like if people like you, you can influence them. There's reciprocity. If you do something for someone, now they feel like they should do something back for you. There's social proof. If people see other people or believe other people are having a result, then they're more likely to be influenced to do the thing. There's, reciprocity, liking, social proof, authority. If people see you as an authority, then there's different types of authority. Anyway, I'm skipping one, but yeah. One is called commitment and consistency, where if somebody is seen as having done a thing, a small example of a thing, like if, so they did this experiment where they went around door to door and they said, hey, do you support, are you against drunk driving? People say, yeah, of course I'm against drunk driving. Awesome. Would you be willing to let us put a billboard in your front yard to support, that you shouldn't do drunk driving? People are like, well, look, I don't support drunk driving, but I don't want a billboard in my yard.
Right.
So
right.
Then they go and they ask people, hey, do you support drunk driving? And people are like, no, I hate drunk driving. And they say, okay, would you be willing to put a little sticker in your window in front of your house that says, like, I think it was for Mothers Against Drunk Driving or something like that, right? And then they would go back and re-canvas the neighborhood and they would go to the houses of people that put the little sticker in their window and say, hey, we're really trying to elevate the message here. We appreciate your support of the work that we're doing. Would you be open to letting us put a billboard in your front yard? And the people that had previously said yes to the little sticker were like so many more times likely to say yes to the billboard because of once we make a commitment, we want subsequent behaviors to be viewed as consistent with our previous commitment.
Sure.
And so when I read this book, it was one of the subsequent times I read the book, I was like, and this was when I was going through a really hard time in my life. And a big part of the work that I do is how do we reduce our reliance on willpower? Because willpower is this depletable resource that's so environmentally impacted and different for different people. And, at the end of the day, if you're like, oh, you just got to muscle through.
Right.
That's going to get different results for different people, let's say, at best. And a lot of times you end up in a loop of shame because you feel like a failure because your willpower was depleted.
Sure.
And so it's like, so when I read this book, I'm like, how do I use these principles on myself? If these, it doesn't require willpower for personality to align with these principles because they're just intrinsic to personality, right?
Sure.
They actually reduce the need for willpower. And so, obviously it's a book about how to influence other people, but how do I use them on myself? And of the six, and by the way, there's ways that you can use all six on yourself.
Sure.
The number one is commitment and consistency. And so the notion of you telling your dad every night what you're going to do the next day reduces the amount of willpower required for you to actually do what you said the next day, because now you effectively have peer pressure.
Right.
And I have used this so many times in my life to get to create these long form constructs where if I don't do it, I just look like a hypocritical idiot.
Right.
And I wanted the audience to hear that unpacking because like, I have found no greater hack in life than to set up the conditions where your natural personality leads you in the direction that you've declared you want to go. And the embarrassment and the humiliation of not going there also leads you in that direction. Hey there, real quick. I just wanted to let you know, I have been concentrating a lot lately on providing tons of value to my text message community. This could be random thoughts. This could be letting you be the first to know about an event I'm planning or a special I'm running or a free training I'm hosting. Anyway, just shoot me a text to get subscribed. The number is 702-996-3926. Thanks so much. Let's get back to the podcast.
Right. Yeah, I think that's brilliant. I'm so glad you did take the time to unpack it, because it was such a big part of my story and the success of it, because it was extremely hard to swim 187 miles. It was much harder to train when you're sick and nobody cares and nobody knows and you're in a stinking chlorine tank all alone with people looking at you because you look sick, like, ooh, are you going to get me sick if you get into the pool? Yeah. And so
people how long was the training regimen?
I started in August of 2013 and I got in the Willamette June. So almost a year, 10 months.
Wow. Okay.
And, you know, the whole time I'm not knowing if the next time I get in the pool, it's going to make me sick. Because one of the ways I almost died was viral meningitis only a year before I started. And I'd gotten that from swimming across a lake in Oklahoma, trying to prove to my daughter that I was strong still, not knowing that I'd swum through blue-green algae and it went up my nose. So one of my doctor friends said, Dean, if you're going to do this, you're going to look like a dork. And I'm like, I kind of already do. He said, wear a nose clip, because at least that way nothing can come up through your nose and hit that semi-permeable membrane again between your sinuses and your brain. So I did that. But the other thing I did that supports your belief that commitment and consistency is important is I started, Instagram was outer space to me at that time. This is 2013, 14. So I got on Facebook and started doing a daily blog on what I was doing and how many laps and how that went. And pretty soon I had 500 of my friends from Kansas. Well, they'd known what I'd been through, and I didn't want to have them see me fail again or get sick again. And so it adds to what you're saying. But I found even a better hack about 6 months into this thing. I've always been a grinder. I got okay at golf, but I wasn't a gifted golfer. I was a really good grinder. I got really good at triathlons. I'd usually end up in the top 20 or so. Again, no gifted, but I always felt like I could withstand pain better than anybody. And I just would crawl deep inside my mind with willpower. And I found myself doing that because there's nothing harder when you're sick to kick off the wall and then come back to it and say, okay, 107 laps to go, 206 laps to go. You're like, oh my God. And I found myself soldiering through these swims. And all of a sudden, one time I'm halfway into the swim, grinding away. And I'm like, wait a minute. I'm not in a hospital. I'm still alive. I'm doing this thing. Why don't I just relax and try to have fun and enjoy this thing? And it brought me to the present moment. And that's something I still do. It's how I start every day. Again, using the power of questions plus this idea of fun. I start every day by looking through my schedule and say, how can I do that and have more fun? And many times I come up with great ideas. Even if I don't, it puts me in a real playful mood and pulls me to the present moment and makes life so much more enjoyable. So every day I'm counting the laps still, but I'm not grinding through. I'm just being grateful, watching the bubbles, thinking, you know, I could be in an oncology ward and I'm out here and I know I'm going to get sick in an hour or so. But I'm doing this thing and I'm getting stronger every day. So I think the commitment and consistency is the foundation. But you put on top of that a nice frosting of fun and it almost makes it a superpower.
Well, yeah. So in my world, you know, a little bit of context, and the audience knows this well, that so I run one of the largest online entrepreneurial education platforms in the world. So
I
we have
that.
hundreds of students, like sometimes 100, 200 students a day coming in saying, I want to do a different thing. I want to change my life. I'm going to make all these commitments and I'm going to follow through on them. And I'm going to, you know, build new habits and build new disciplines. And like, cause we're very open, like, hey, entrepreneurship is hard. Doesn't matter if it's online, offline.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not just about like learning some new skills. It's really becoming a new version of yourself that's going to be able to execute, especially because right out of the gate, you're probably not going to be able to quit your day job. You're going to have to add this to the mix for a long time before you can completely transition.
Sure.
And so I see folks, you know, making these, I have this unique vantage point, right, of seeing thousands of people say what they're going to do and then actually getting to observe who actually follows through and who does it. And that's why I'm so obsessed with these principles. I'm trying to teach people, like, here's how you can hack yourself and trick yourself and entrap yourself into positivity, basically. And the number one thing, this is no surprise to anyone, but I mean, the number one thing that helps us follow through on things is the term we use is gamification. When you can make something into a game.
There you go. Yeah.
And that's when you say fun, that's what I hear is it's like, and I play these tricks on myself all the time. It's like, what's my little reward going to be when I do that thing?
Yeah. And for me, it went just a step beyond. The reward wasn't at the end. It was the doing.
Yeah.
And being there doing it. And it had never been that before for me. It had always been the medal at the end of the race or just knowing that you'd gotten to the top of the mountain. But all of a sudden, I broke through. No, the reward is really just being alive and it not being perfect and you being scared, but finding the courage to do it and enjoy it.
Yeah.
And that's really what carried me through that 187 miles. That burst I had in the pool has really stayed with me ever since.
Well, I feel like fun, I'd have to go look it up. I made a post about what fun is. I don't remember exactly what I said, but when I think of fun or I think of games, you know, games are fun. You don't have to wait for the end for a game to be fun. A game is fun in the middle. And it, to me, it's a relationship with the future. When you're having fun, what you're doing is you're declaring a certain relationship with the future where you're saying, I'm going to devalue the consequences. That's what fun is. Fun is doing something without worrying about what's going to happen later.
Right. And getting lost in the moment of the flow of whatever it is you're doing.
And the biggest, the best, again, trick or hack I have found for reducing my concern about the future, which unlocks the fun in the moment, you said it, is gratitude.
Right.
That when you can suddenly say, hey, I'm not dead. I'm not in a hospital or I'm not in Gaza
right
now.
Right.
Like, I am so grateful. I'm so grateful to be in the United States with my ostensibly shitty circumstances that could be so much worse.
So much worse.
And if now you can have fun.
Think they could be, you're wrong. I learned very quickly, Jeff, to say, well, I couldn't, you know, I lost my wife. It couldn't get worse. Oh, then I got cancer. Well, I lost my wife and I got cancer. Couldn't get worse. Then I got $500,000 of medical bills. Well, I paid all these medical bills and now I'm broke. It couldn't get worse. I learned you just can't think like that or say that out loud. You got to flip it on its head and say, hey, these things have happened, but I'm not dead yet. I've got agency. I've got power. I've got the power of choice. So,
yeah, go read Man's Search for Meaning.
Right.
Go read The Gulag Archipelago by Solzhenitsyn. I mean, go read the freaking four gospels in the Bible and what happened to Jesus. I mean, whether you believe in Jesus was the son of God or not, historically that happened to a man named Jesus and or Yeshua. It could be worse. Let's be clear.
It can't be always. But anyway, so stepped into the Willamette on June 3rd. It was, a lot of people don't know the Willamette is largely a snowmelt river. And depending on how much snow we've had here in Oregon, the winter before, it depends, it either creates, you know, a river in the 50s or in the 40s. That year we'd had a lot of snow. And so when I stepped in, it was 42 degrees. And that sounds warm to some people. Only the people that have never gotten in 42 degree water.
That's and not warm. Even,
no, it was almost bone shatteringly cold.
Yeah, that's like what people do
10 to 12 hours a day.
Yeah, when people do cold therapy, they're typically doing it in water that's high 30s, low 40s.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so even with the 3 mil wetsuit, I would go into thrombosis, or what they call deep core throttle hypothermia, where I can feel my internal organs banging against my ribs, and I start to get fuzzy headed, and I'd have to get out and do jumping jacks or run in place for about 5-10 minutes just to warm my body up to get back in and do it again. And I was going into that hypothermia probably 5 to 8 times a day. And I thought that was the biggest challenge. But one of the things that just is a pet peeve of mine is I watch these documentaries about these extreme endurance athletes or these adventurers, and the whole time they're crying and whining. Oh, I hurt. Oh, I'm tired. And I'm like, you know, you chose it. Nobody forced you to do this. And so I promised myself, with the help of the Almighty, I am not going to complain one time. And that was my big goal, to go through this and never complain. And so that kind of kept my mouth shut and kept me from feeling sorry for myself, knowing that I'd chosen this, but being constantly cold and tired and doing 10 to 12 miles a day for 22 days, I thought that was the hardest challenge. Lo and behold, first blood test I took after I was done, I went down to one of the world's...
But before you say that, how many days did it take to swim the river?
It took me 22 days.
Okay.
I took two Sundays off. One, just... People are like, well, Dean, did you take Sunday off because you're really religious? No, that wasn't it as much as one of the things I do with every one of my routines is I try to embed purposeful imperfection, because I'm such a perfectionist that if I don't prove that I can do this thing and still be imperfect, then I get in my head. And so even when I do these world record swims, I'll take a day off or do something to prove to myself in the world I can create a world's first and still be imperfect. I don't have to be perfect to do this. And so I took the day off. Thankfully, it also helped my body to rest. The second time I took a Sunday off, my doctor asked me to take 2 days off instead of one because I was down to less than 3% body fat, which I thought was a problem. Lo and behold, I didn't know anything about brown fat, but when you get down that low, it starts to pull all the stores of brown fat, which super fuel and boost your immune system. So they think that was another reason that the first blood test I took after the 22-day journey, my leukemia was mysteriously gone without chemo or radiation.
So, wow. And
yeah, it was a big wow for me,
and gratitude, and man, so much we could probably learn that I wish we had way more time to talk about. But yeah, so I'm curious, like, how have you sort of ultimately processed all this? I mean, first of all, you alluded earlier that there was a psychosomatic element to the cancer in the first place, that it came from the loss of your wife. It sounds like you've connected those. And by the way, psychosomatic doesn't mean it's made up. It means that the mind changes the state of the body.
Right.
And sometimes people think psychosomatic means like you're imagining it. No, but that your cancer came from a psychological, it had a psychological origin. So now I'm curious, like, And then I'm thinking of like Wim Hof and like the Iceman method, and that like cold in and of itself is so, what do they call that? Hormetic stress is highly curative. But so, I mean, I'm sure the audience is asking the same question, like, okay, great. Cause everybody knows somebody who's got cancer or had it. Like, what happened? What do you think happened?
Well, I think several things. I'd never heard of Wim Hof. I didn't hear of him till about 6 months later, and I'm giving a speech, and I always do a question and answer time, and people are like, hey, do you know about Wim Hof? I'm like, no, is that a vacuum cleaner? I don't know. And I found out about his work, and it was so reassuring to see the research he'd done to prove the science behind what had happened, because it was inexplicable. Yeah. The second thing is, I don't know if you've heard of Wallace G. Nichols and the Blue Mind. Wallace G. Nichols is a marine biologist that lives in Southern California that wrote a New York Times bestseller called Blue Mind. And he found that with psychoneurologists that universally the brain is hardwired to resonate with water. Anytime we're in, on, around, by, or underwater, within about a minute or two, our brain goes into a meditative state. Well, I'm with water flowing day in and day out for 3 weeks, which is now what they think is kind of the parameter to create a new habit. And all of a sudden, all this trauma, because from the night a little before my wife died to after, I had 3 to 6 nightmares a night for various reasons. I mean, it was just what they call traumatic bereavement. And I was just constantly thinking about it, constantly dreaming about it, keeping that cortisol in that cortisol just flooding through my body, and my body just wrapped and tightened up so greatly that I couldn't ever decompress and get a breath. That's one we're talking about psychosomatics. I believe there are those of us that are so tightly wired that if we get traumatized, it creates a disease condition. And that's one way cancer can come. My wife was a rural farm girl. And one of her funniest stories was when her aunt, uncle and father would have her hold the guide flags for the crop dusters, and she'd end up white from DDT. We thought it was hilarious until she died. And a lot of them back there were so poisoned with pesticides that a lot of them are suffering from blood cancers or brain cancer or Parkinson's. And we, you know, so there are some folks that just get poisoned. Yeah. I think there's also a third reason so many people in America especially are getting cancer. And that's because we become so disconnected from nature. We are evolutionarily hardwired to resonate and to thrive in nature. And we are so disconnected from it that I believe that creates a fragile, diseased condition in our bodies.
So you kind of had this, like, at least a trifecta. You had regrounding in nature.
Right.
You had 22 days of shocking cold therapy.
Right.
You also had the larger meaning and purpose, the logotherapeutic orientation of this goal. Mm-hmm. And I will say, you know, I'll just sort of briefly say that every person I've ever talked to about purpose and meaning, which I'm blessed to say I've talked to a lot of people about that, and a lot of people, especially a lot of people who have profoundly demonstrated the power of purpose and meaning in their life. Like, that's one of the greatest joys of my life. It always, at this point, I'm willing to say it as an absolute, like, scientific theory. It always involves inspiring other people.
Right.
Like, doesn't matter what your purpose is or what flavor.
It's not about you.
Yeah. And so you had that too with, like, inspiring other patients. So you actually had sort of these four elements.
Right.
That I would say, even if we don't fully understand the science, that certainly those help explain the miracle.
I think so. And that purpose, I call it the big dream. And I've helped many since find, identify their big dream and then chase it. And I believe once you do, one of the things that's been so pleasant for me to discover is as I ask people what their big dream is, many times at first they don't know, but very quickly they remember. I said, well, you had a big dream at one time. What was it? And they always remember, and there are always glimmers of it throughout their life. You know, I'd been swimming alpine lakes and rivers with my parents, and my parents applauding me my whole life. And so it wasn't, and I'd seen them adventure in nature. So it wasn't this huge leap for me, whereas maybe it would have been somebody else. And your big dream has led you to this. And there were glimmers of that all over your life. And that following that big dream, it gives you that purpose, but it also has you do the things you need to do and meet the people you need to meet in order to heal and really inspire and contribute to the rest of our world.
Yeah, so it's interesting. In Entre, underneath our methods, I remember having this epiphany early in the construction of it, that essentially I'm taking a logotherapeutic approach to entrepreneurship. That the set of habits and behaviors required to actually succeed as an entrepreneur are difficult enough that they will create extreme discomfort unless you harness deeper principles and orient your life toward its true purpose. And that led me into like a lot of etymological exploration. For example, the word fulfillment comes from the Old English word for destiny or prophecy. There's this purpose that has already been preordained for you.
Right.
And you, right. We all want to be fulfilled, but we are fulfilled when we fulfill our destiny.
Right.
And that's our purpose. And that's our meaning. And that was all. And to your point, when even man searched for meaning, I love that that concept was developed by Viktor Frankl in the absolute most desolate place imaginable, geographically and spiritually and emotionally and in every way, because there was nowhere external to search for meaning. So it's so implicit that the search is within.
Right.
And it's within our psyches and it's within our life experiences. I love that you made that connection that, like, my friend Dov Baron calls it the red thread. It's always been woven through the tapestry of our life from the very beginning. And the search for meaning is a historical review of our life. Because the seeds are all there. Man, I'm gonna go ahead and say like we should do a part two at some point because I've got to wrap and this is great.
This is gonna make me sound like a little fangirl, but I'm such a big fan of yours. Whatever you want to do, I'm in, man.
you're the least sexy fangirl I've ever come across, but I still appreciate it.
Least sexy, fill in the blank.
although it sounds like you've gotten sexier since you got over your lumpy, emaciated, cancerous.
I couldn't have gotten worse, that's for sure. when I was really complaining, my dad's like, well, you never were a pretty boy, Dean.
Yeah, it's nice to never have been born under the delusion that we were terribly good looking. I can relate to that.
That's for sure.
Dean, this has been wonderful. Please share with the audience. I know you have an amazing book that's, sure, you know, recounts this journey. You do coaching work. Like, how can the world go get more Dean Hall goodness?
Yeah, we came out with the book about the Willamette River. I was privileged. My daughter's become an author and a writer, and she helped me write the book about the Willamette journey. And we did something, we had two aims for it. Number one, make it a fun, easy read, even though there are some really hard times that are elicited in that book. But secondly, we tried three iterations and I just wasn't happy with them because it sounded like it was all about me and I was bragging, and that's just not me. And we found this thing called Braided Interview, where you interview everybody on the team, and then you take each piece of that, weave them together, and it creates the narrative. And so it's almost like reading a documentary where everybody's talking about it. And the fun thing is it really shows how we each are really living our own adventure, even when we're adventuring with someone else, and how we remember everything differently. So that's called The Wild Cure from Death to Life on Oregon's Longest River, and it can be found on Amazon. And then also, I'm doing a lot of coaching now and really hoping that I lead therapy and coaching out of its tiny, tight little box. You know, a lot of people don't know the second most powerless position to the unconscious in the body is a seated position. And yet we sit people down and ask them what they're feeling powerless about and hope that that then gives them power. Somehow it just doesn't make sense organically and to our bodies. And so what I do is I get people up walking, because walking empowers you. You're moving forward. And I walk them out into the wilderness and then challenge them and teach them how to ground with earth, or sit around and tell a story around a fire, or flow with water, or feel the wind and be inspired by it. And so I use the four elements and a lot of the things I've learned to heal to take their coaching not only here, but down into their body. And I've had quite a bit of success with that. And so I lead retreats and do coaching. I still do some remote coaching, but I give them assignments to get out in nature every week. And especially men really love that format. So I'm having a lot of fun with that.
Yeah, I was looking at your website, which we'll put all the links in the show notes,
sure,
but the Wild Cure Way. .com, and looking at the, you know, the experiential getaways and out in nature work that you do. And I'm like, dude, this is so awesome. I got a lot out of therapy, but it was like you said, it was all, and that was because I had an incredibly loving and conscious therapist, but
oh, good.
Dang, to be out in nature, man.
Yeah. There's
whole other level.
That takes it to another level. Certainly. Yeah.
Well, Dean, thank you again. I am saying that, you know, goodness knows when it'll be, but like, I'm excited to do a part two at some point.
Oh, me too.
And I have enjoyed this immensely. Thanks for being a guest on Unlock Your Potential.
So have I. I've been honored, Jeff. Thank you for having me.
And of course, to all you viewers and listeners out there, as I tell you every time, you are the best part of the show. Even when Dean's on, you're still the best part of the show.
No, certainly.
You're why I do it every single day. And I'm so glad we got to spend this time together. Catch you next time.
Hey, it's Jeff here. If you liked this episode of Unlock Your Potential, it would mean so much if you would like and share the episode on whatever platform you're listening or viewing on. And if you really like what we're doing here and you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review. There is so much work that goes into these episodes, and you leaving a positive review lets us know that that work is reaching people, and especially it helps us reach other people. Your review could be the reason that someone else decides to tune in, check out this podcast, and unlock their potential and ultimately level up the quality of their life. So thank you so much for your support and for listening, especially if you like or share or leave a review. Thank you for helping us spread the word, and thank you for unlocking your potential to go make the world and your world a better place.